Susan, there are two shows that you have on at the moment in London. There's the one that's in front of us here at Gampel Fies and the concurrent one at the Freud Museum, which is part of a larger series of exhibitions to do with the relationships between visual art and text. Could we start perhaps by talking about this show here at Gampel's? As in some of the work that you've done in the past, the paintings that are here use wallpaper as a background and support. The ones that you did in the mid-80s that I remember particularly concentrated on the kind of wallpaper that you might find in the bedroom of a young boy or a young girl. But the range here seems to be much broader. There are nursery papers, but also others that seem to be related to other kinds of domestic spaces.
You know, I always get really annoyed when people want to talk about the wallpaper as a separate thing, and I think this is actually one of the problems with the fact that I tend to emphasize the nature of the artifact that I start with, and I maintain it as a sign instead of getting rid of it or turning it into something else. And then people always want to talk about that sign, which to me has absolutely nothing to do with the final work except as a starting point. So yes, of course, there are different wallpapers here, but in the intervening years between the ones that you're referring to and this series, I mean, I have been showing work abroad consistently, you know, a number of shows every year, and so to me there's not such an abrupt jump. It's been more of a gradual evolution. I suppose as soon as I began to realize that beyond the more obvious kind of gendered and ideological messages, if you like, that were being conveyed by some of the more blatant wallpapers, in fact, almost every kind of wallpaper has a very long history in terms of a kind of a genre. So you get, you know, all the fruit and flower ones, which have to do with certain kinds of painting, and also, in a sense, beyond that, kind of function as memento mori, you know, and so forth and so on. I mean, in a way, what interests me now about starting with the papers, as well as the fact that they're a cultural ground upon which real work can make some sort of change, aside from that, there's the fact that they seem to go back art historically, right, as well as sociologically, a very long way. So, for example, in these pictures that we're looking at now, the papers are almost obliterated in some cases, right? Because what I've been doing is to see them as a ground for rewriting, which has always been the case. But in this series, the rewriting has been covered up with other rewritings till it sometimes often reaches the point of semi-obliteration. And then what I've done, because I am in some sense anxious to keep that balance between the idea of a, you know, cultural determinants and kind of subjective ones, and to emphasize the interplay between those, then I have sort of brought back the cultural ground again in the framing, which is not obliterated at all, and you can see that that is a wallpaper and you can read it as such. And that's meant to, I guess, sort of imply that you could go on with this dialectical play back and forth between a kind of disfiguring or obliterating of a cultural ground and then its return. It's a kind of cycle.
The kind of obliteration that you're talking about literally is using black paint, which is more or less, as you say, obscuring the pattern, and that itself is figured in certain ways that suggest both the use of brushes, but also perhaps the use of hands and fingers.
You know, I'm going back in my own mind to add Reinhardt, which is somebody I've spoken about and used as a reference point in my own way, and thinking about this idea of blackness as having everything present within it. My blackness is achieved literally through writing and rewriting, or writing and brushing out, or even, as you say, sometimes touching out. although there is a distinction in my mind between the ones that emphasize touch. For example, this larger picture, which is called Witness, and the so-called dirty paintings, the small ones, are very much handmade in the sense that it's a hands-on kind of process, whereas the black ones really have been done by writing.
And there are also on them, in them, texts, which yes. are your yes. automatic That's writing right. texts That's right. as well.
Yes, so there are, when I say written, I mean literally, graphically, written in the sense of marks, which are crypto-linguistic, covering them in a certain way. And then those marks are rubbed out or painted over, and other marks are laid down.
Has the way in which you use automatic writing changed for you over the years?
Well, from my point of view, the ongoingness, right, of these sort of mark-making or linguistically oriented, if you like, works, runs alongside all the other pieces that I've done. So that the kinds of things we're looking at now in the gallery tend to be things that I'm always making, right? Now, out of that practice emerges from time to time maybe a much bigger, more public kind of work, like an entertainment or other works of that sort, big installation pieces. But what I'm engaged in much of the time is this sort of practice. So the use of automatic writing, if you like, hasn't changed in that it has an ongoingness from the early 70s, but perhaps the way it's being presented now, for more public looking, has a different appearance. But you know, my studio is just filled with sheets of paper with this kind of mark making practice, which for me is the closest I get, I suppose, to kind of drawing. Since I never represent anything when I'm drawing, I'm writing. Yeah. And a lot of the materials in those ashes pieces, the reconstituted work, are just, you know, folders and folders of these sort of texts.
The kinds of public, more public pieces that I take you to be referring to, as you say, things like An Entertainment or Magic Lantern or Belshazzar's Feast or Elan or something, monument, they have used time-based media of one sort or another.
Let's just be very simple. Object making and event making, okay, are exactly the same thing. It simply depends on a time scale, so that if you are looking at something over a longer period of time, objects are just things that are held together in a certain way, whereas an event or, you know, a performance or an installation, which comes down, goes up at a certain point, lasts or holds together for a less long period of time as a bounded unit. Does that make any sense to you? So I can't see that my making of one of the black works, which might go on over 3 or 4 years, I might continue to return to it, is very different from something like An Entertainment, in that you can see a videotape as something that unrolls in time, and you cover it with images in a certain way, and you superimpose on top of that. But then, of course, when you present it, it has a beginning and an end, but that's very arbitrary. It could go on forever. Now, the thing is that the whole notion of this exhibition was in a way to draw attention to that kind of dilemma, because there are pieces in this exhibition which to me carry as much weight as the works on canvas, which we're calling, for lack of a better term, paintings, right? But the ashes pieces, for instance, have been ongoing for more than 20 years. And so here was an opportunity, it seemed to me a kind of anniversary in a way, of saying, okay, these pieces, this is an event I've been participating in for 20 years, and it leaves these little registrations, you know. Now, when I began to do that, it was what used to be called private performance or enactment or something that sort of vaguely related to the idea of event structures. But when you've got a lot of souvenirs of these event structures, you have a work, you have something that's bounded in a way. But the actual activity that goes to create those objects is ongoing.
The way in which you've presented these ash pieces here, there are two works. There's the one on the wall behind us, Hand Grenades, mm-hmm. and the one on a shelf, a lead shelf, which is a series of calibrated test tubes with stoppers, which are placed in groups in beakers, in laboratory beakers. There seem to be references, or there are references to other areas of practice or to other areas of thought, the scientific as opposed to the artistic, the military, but also the hand grenades. They look like light bulbs too, mm. so there's a sense of kind of illumination that's coming
on. Well, the hand grenades, just to start with that, they are all using laboratory glassware and domestic kitchen bowl, in fact. So to me, they're located between the laboratory and the kitchen, which is very important. I mean, I used to have up in my studio a very long time ago a phrase from Charlie Parker, which is something like, I made my fire, I greased my skillet, and I cooked, you know, which has to do with jazz. It also has to do with alchemy, right? And it has to do with transformation. And I mean, he's using the kitchen as a metaphor. And all those themes are present in this work, and the idea of fire as a sort of transformative element. But the reason for the title Hand Grenades is because the shape of these little glass things look like, to me, like hand grenades, but also because what's being recycled in that piece, what I burned, was a very early series of works of mine which were called hand paintings, which were group events that culminated in enormous paintings using the human hand. And this was prior to Richard Long and Tony Stubbings and all these other people using hands. And the only reason we were doing it on canvas was because I was interested in the notion of the earliest known human marks, which are hands on cave walls and so forth, and the idea of making your mark and so forth. Anyway, those were recycled very early on, a very long time ago, and they were hand paintings, so they became hand grenades, that's all. But they also look like light bulbs, and the idea of illumination is just as important, but I didn't call them that. Now, the calibrated tubes were simply initially a convenient receptacle, and I clearly at some point bought an enormous box of old school chemistry lab glassware, which I still have and use for various things. It's a tremendously useful resource. What they're placed in are actually glass tanks, which have something to do with old batteries, called activator tanks, I think is what they're called. And that, again, was initially just a found object that seemed to make sense to put them in. And they're organized by five-yearly units, and just another way of counting them up and holding them together. The thing that interests me about the calibrations on those particular tubes is that they're so clearly subjective. It's hard to believe they could all be supposedly measuring the same amount, but they are.
The problem of making something of these remnants for the viewer, you know, who obviously hasn't seen the actual stuff in the studio that you've been working on, which you've then transformed in these events or whatever into the ash, is also, it seems to me, figured in the works on the wall, which, as you say, we will call paintings for the want of a better word. The kinds of titles that you've given to them, you've already mentioned Witness, but there's also Sybil, there's Sophia, there's this idea of various ways in which you might come to know something, either through being present or through engaging in some process which is understood to be rational or whatever. That seems to be important. There's this range of different ways of apprehending knowledge.
Yes,
yes.
It's not about rationality, though. That's going to get us down the wrong track. I refuse to be drawn on that. The point I'm trying to make in this configuration of objects that I've placed here in this geographically bounded space, okay, it has to do with some query about the nature of objects and how they all can exist in the world at the same time, and we can construct meanings on the basis of their existence. So I have very deliberately gone across the kinds of boundaries that you might normally find in exhibitions. So there are these painting-like objects, there are these sculptural objects, I mean sculptural in every sense, not just formally, I'm talking about the glass and ash pieces, but also in terms of the deliberate time base that is built into them, you'd have to call them sculptural, right? There's also a little installation of a door and some other objects, and a video. And placing these all together elicits quite, in the normal course of events, a reading on the part of any viewer. That is, we are always making sense of the disparate collections of things that our world consists of. People are constantly doing this from childhood onward, telling a narrative, making sense of collections of different kinds. And the choice, then, of these things together seemed to me to suggest a certain kind of story that I could make up on the basis of it. And I was trying to propose a little question, I guess, to the viewer, the same kind of question I always feel when I walk into somebody else's exhibition, like, what are these things and why are they all here together? In other words, I don't think installation art is a very meaningful category, because any bunch of stuff in a place, you know, lends itself to that kind of construction of meaning on the basis of the selection, right?
This other object, which has been mentioned a few times but not yet really talked about, is a steel mesh security door, which I understand usually covers up the entrance to your studio. And in the center of this, on one side, there's a black rubber mat, a rectangular mat, on which is hanging in a polythene cover a little baby's outfit of trousers and a top with a hood. And it's sort of white and yellowy, greeny striped. And then on the chest of the top of this outfit, there's a star, a white star that's been sewn. A six-pointed star made out of two triangles.
I found it in a shop selling children's clothes by different trendy young designers, basically. And when I saw this one, I was very shocked, because what it evokes is it's kind of archetypal concentration camp, yellowish, white, striped thing. And hanging on its little hanger, it looks incredibly deformed and tortured, and it's in this kind of body bag. It's exactly how it was hanging. And of course the six-pointed star with these other elements kind of reads as a sign, you know, it's a certain sign, and you think it has to do with, or I did and everybody else who was with me thought it had to do with something to do with concentration camps, something of the sort. Of course, it is meant to be a little designer baby grow for a Rastafarian child, because this Star of Judah is also the Star of David, Lion of Judah kind of imagery is characteristic of that religion as well. So it made me think about this idea of reading, misreading, and something appearing to be the already known, but not being that at all. To me, this entire show has a kind of provocative edge, which I guess that's a sign for, so that the rather moody, if you like, look of the paintings and the ashes and the whole implied narrative of that, and the video, which, as I've explained to you, was actually a camera obscura, we can come back to talk about that later, but does reference in a way to these images of train journeys in films like Showa or whatever, just this kind of notion of movement through Europe, you know, where you don't actually see people, you just see train tracks, and immediately it evokes a kind of recent European horror. So I'm aware of the fact that these objects were all selected around that kind of mood, if you like. And this little Babylon suit is a sign for that, right? Nevertheless, beyond that immediate emotional charge of, like, black paintings or ashes or concentration camp suit, there's a different kind of reality, which it seems to me is actually what the work in the show is about.
There seem to be many strands of that which also are evident in the Freud Museum work. The Freud piece consists of a whole series of cardboard boxes with various items that have been collected in them. There are the items and a text or an image or a related text or image pasted onto the inside of the box lid. This idea of remembering or forgetting seems to come up in that piece. Mm. And also the exploration of specifically Jewish ethnicity.
In a way, to say that the pieces in the Freud Museum that I've made relate in some sense to Freud's own collection is fairly accurate, although I started the piece long before I was ever invited to exhibit it in the Freud Museum. And of course, you can't deal with Freud and his collection in any way at all without taking on board Freud's own ethnicity and the implications of that. But really, what all those pieces are about is about the European notion of otherness and the resources, psychological resources found in the notion of otherness, whether it's of an exotic past or, you know, a different ethnic group or whatever, the positive and negative possibilities within that. And it's asking the question, I suppose, about who am I? Who is anyone? If we're constructed with these different paradoxical references to identity, which is, of course, what the show that we're looking at now is about to some extent, too. But in the Freud Museum piece, the major difference for me is that that is situated within a kind of terrain where the language that we use both within the work, since I'm using language in the ordinary sense as well as image, and also in discussing the work, we can use in a very resourceful way with reference to psychoanalysis, anthropology, the discourse of the museum, etc., etc. It's all like readily available. What we've got is a vitrine, a big glass vitrine, which in fact pre-existed in the Freud Museum, but I had to completely remake. I mean, all the shelves, the material, the lighting, everything has been completely redone in order to make it look as though nothing had ever been done. But I couldn't use what they had there originally, and yet I was constrained to use that particular room and so forth. So that in itself is a paradox, you know. And it's about, you know, replacing something. And then it's a series of cardboard boxes, which are in fact archaeological collecting boxes. And you know, when you're working on site as an archaeologist, you start throwing the little significant bits. You're already making decisions. You know, this will go in my box, this will not go in my box, sort of thing. And then you add to that box relevant materials that you may have, texts or whatever, and it becomes the basis of a typology or classification and a chronology, right? So Freud used the archaeological metaphor to refer to psychoanalysis, and that's the kind of takeoff point for the piece in terms of its form. But this is quite an interesting little interplay, and I don't know if you watch any of the films at the Freud Museum, the family home movies that they put on video, but one of them shows Freud deep in conversation with his oldest friend, apparently, who was a professor of archaeology. And they used to get together once a year and have, you know, conversations and so forth. So, I mean, this commitment to archaeology was a very, very important part of Freud's thinking, embedded in his thinking. And it was also a way of rejecting the notion of representation, which I found quite interesting. Because he said that, you know, you could talk and describe the different archaeological layers in a city like Rome, that this had built on this and this and this, and but in the end you would come to the exhaustion of representation. You could no longer begin to picture it. And therefore, the whole notion of picturing was inadequate for dealing with unconscious contents, which I think is quite fascinating. It's taken us a long way from the boxes of the Freud Museum, but one of the things that was fascinating for me about that opportunity to work in the museum was that I did get back into doing a lot of reading about Freud and reading Freud's texts and so forth, and something I'd been, you know, quite alienated from for a number of years, I think mainly because of the use that psychoanalysis has been put within the art world, which I have found a very, to have had a very sort of stultifying, repressive effect on contemporary art practice, in that psychoanalysis is still seen by non-psychoanalysts, I must add, as the most hierarchically superior position from which to speak. And it tends to be spoken in the art world in an authoritative, coded language, which is, of course, something that I find very distasteful, and also something that I find very odd, why kind of artists would accept that kind of censoriousness under the guise of psychoanalysis. Nevertheless, for me, the experience of rereading Freud's text was very moving.
There are a couple of things that I want to mention coming out of that. The first one is, I suppose, another view on the Freud collection. Quite an interesting one that was written about by Louise Bourgeois a few years ago. An exhibition was made of Freud's collection
of antiques.
That went around the States, and Bourgeois wrote about this and referred to the collection collectively as Freud's toys, and described them in a way, I suppose, which is very relevant to the kind of material that it is that you collect, which is that these were not particularly privileged objects that he had. They were, you know, mass-produced sort of votive things that existed in their countless hundreds, and that they just happened to have survived. And so it was really the very ordinary, the absolutely ordinary, that Freud was collecting there. And the other thing was that she questioned this relationship, I suppose, from a 20th century viewpoint, of the kind of scientific basis of both archaeology and psychoanalysis, in that really digging is such a loose metaphor that it really describes absolutely anything that we really do when we address any kind of problem.
I'm always trying to argue for the primacy or the equality of all kinds of expressive practices, because I cannot see that art as a practice is any less elucidating, if you like, or epistemologically rich than psychoanalysis or sociology or whatever. The notion of play, which was what I was thinking of when you were talking about what Bourgeois said, is absolutely fascinating, because, of course, Freud played with these things all the time. This is a very important aspect of his collection. They were very touchable, you know, and he had those ones on his desk. And he would sort of hold them up and say to people, well, you know, if you look at this Athena, you know, and then he'd put it down, he'd pick up another one. Now, the thing that's odd about that is that he read from the objects to reality. In other words, the myths that were embedded in the objects has some kind of interesting confusion about objectivity. You know, there's this object, it represents a myth, therefore the myth has some kind of truth, therefore we'll tell you this myth and that'll help you with your own problems. Kind of a weird little confusion, which is absolutely rich, you know, and exciting, and seems very art-like to me, and have absolutely nothing to do with any kind of like scientific way of going about anything. So putting my little collection there was like a tiny footnote to all of this. The thing that's different about my collection is that my collection is rubbish. I mean, it's not like I would go out and buy these. Mine is all rubbish. They really have absolutely no intrinsic value. A lot of them are things that I felt impelled to rescue. The Jewish artifacts, which are books mainly, were all on a skip. I found them on a skip. And so on. But what I'm trying to get at is that I don't think you can set a theoretical practice up as a model that a material-based practice should emulate or aspire to or be conditioned by or whatever, because I don't think it works that way around. I think possibly the very way that artistic practices tend to operate, where a great deal escapes from conscious control, whether or not you have what you think is an already theorized discourse or not, that's what makes it interesting. You know, art is less censorious in that way. We can sneak things through.
Janine Anthony, we're in the Anthony Doffey Gallery, and I've come to see your piece called Slumber, and we'll talk more in detail about that a little bit later. But looking at earlier works, and having seen the piece Loving Care, it's clear that your body is central to the process of you making your work, and I wondered if we could start by you elaborating on that.
In all my works, I try to call attention to the body by using the body as the tool for making. So, for instance, in my piece Gnaw, I wanted to carve, but instead of using a hammer and chisel, I used my mouth. And in Loving Care, I had this idea of thinking about painting, and action painting specifically, but rather than using a paintbrush, I used my hair. In Slumber, I became fascinated with this machine, which is the polyosomnograph, which is a machine that they use to record physiologically what's happening when you're in a sleep state. And this machine seemed terrific because it was just like all my other work, that science had somehow made a machine for the body to make a drawing. And so the machine is recording my rapid eye movement, which is associated with dreams. So maybe that drawing would even be coming from the unconscious, which seemed to have interesting implications in terms of art making.
You mentioned the piece Loving Care and the work Gnaw, and there seems to be several instances in those works where you're both conversing with and quoting from art history. You know, in Loving Care, it's the idea of the hair being used expressionistically. In Gnaw, you have this kind of minimalist cube. I wondered if you could elaborate a bit on those references.
In Gnaw, what I did is I casted 600 pounds of chocolate in a large cube on a marble pedestal, and I also casted in the exact same size 500 pounds of lard. And I was very interested in the fact that that was a sort of icon of minimalism, the cube, and I thought I was hoping that it would be quite funny for me to be chewing on this big icon of minimalism. I'm sort of interested in the fact that, you know, the cube has almost become a cliche of minimalism. And later on in the piece, what I spit out from the lard and chocolate, I recast into other forms. The chocolate is cast into packaging, heart-shaped packaging for chocolate candy, and the lipstick is mixed with pigment and beeswax and makes 400 lipstick, and all of that is put into a cosmetic display. And so I want to sort of put together ideas of aesthetics and art in almost their cliche forms, and butt that up against ideas of woman and beauty. And the same thing happens in Loving Care, where I'm interested in referencing abstract expressionism, Pollock, but more specifically Klein and those blue women. And my favorite quote of Klein's in reference to those paintings is he said, rather than to paint the model, I want to paint with the model. And my response to that would be that Loving Care is about the contradictions of trying to be the model and the master at the same time. And what I'm mopping the floor with is Loving Care hair dye. And so that has its references to beauty and adorning the body and transforming it into something we think is aesthetically more appealing.
It also, of course, refers to the menial task often carried out by women in our society of cleaning the floor, of cleansing.
Well, I was very interested in this idea of mopping, and that, you know, it's traditionally associated with women's work, not necessarily something that I do very often, but I'm interested in how we think about those forms of labor. And all my work calls attention to the making process and the meaning that is inherent in the making process. And my feeling is that, you know, we've sort of lost contact with where, you know, everyday objects that we've come in contact with, where they come from, how they were made. And my feeling is if I can give the history of how an object makes its way into the world, that that will create a certain relationship to that object.
So what you're saying is that the process is certainly as important as the product, but another element to a work that involves process is performance, and in Loving Care, one read it, in a sense, as a live event. That seems to be another characteristic of your works, that of personal participation through time.
All the work is sort of walking a fine line between object, performance, relic, and process. And I don't consider myself a performance artist or a process artist, but the reasons I use those forms is to call attention to the making and the meaning and the making. And I'm always pushing my body to an extreme, and I hope that the viewer can somehow relate to that, and that that will create a charged relationship to what I'm doing. Maybe I should talk to you about Eureka, which is a piece that I did where I dipped myself in a tub of lard. And then I was pulled out, and I displaced the lard in the tub. So I took my body capacity in fat, and I mixed it with lye and water, and I created a big cube of soap. And then I washed myself with the cube, so I sort of smoothed down the cube by bathing with it. And so in a sense, just like Na, where I transform the cube through biting, here I transform the cube through bathing. And I'm interested in the lard because it's the material of the body. And soap was a wonderful medium for me because it's sort of, soap is made out of lard. So I love this idea that here I am sort of washing myself with myself, that if I use my body capacity in lard and make the cube with it, somehow I've entered the cube, and then I wash myself with myself.
Another work which involves an intervention by you is Lick and Lather, which was in the Aperto section at the Venice Biennale, seven neoclassical busts cast in chocolate, seven in soap. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that piece.
Sure. For me, Lick and Lather is a culmination of all the works that we've been talking about, in terms that, you know, I have the chocolate of Na, and I have the soap from Eureka. And this idea from Eureka that I was washing myself with myself is what brought me to the idea for Lick and Lather. And I made a very sort of tentative step into working with a representation of the body. Up until this point, I had only worked with a sort of residue of my interaction with the object. And so I thought that I would take Eureka one more step, and that I would literally wash myself with myself. So what I did with Lick and Lather is I cast 14 self-portrait busts, seven in chocolate and seven in soap. And I decided to use seven because that's the classical proportions of the body. And the way I did it is I took a product name called alginate, which is what the dentists use to get a very detailed impression of your teeth. And what I did is I submerged my entire head in the stuff so I could get an extremely exact replica of my body. So in fact, that there would be no real sculpting going on in the original image, but the only sculpting would happen through licking and washing. So after getting these exact replicas of myself, I took the soap busts and I brought them in the bathtub with me, and we washed together. And then I took several days to lick each head, transforming my image. And I started to think about the bust as a way, you know, one way we want to immortalize ourselves through this kind of image. And I like the fact that the materials I'm using are ephemeral and do have a lifespan. And it was great because I showed this piece in Aperto in the Venice Biennial. And I was very aware that there would be these classical sculptures everywhere. But what I wasn't aware with is that of course, everything in Venice is eroding. And I was walking around looking at these statues that had been worn down by the weather, and they looked very much like my heads. So I was thinking, well, you know, we make a self-portrait bust to immortalize ourselves, but it seemed to me that, you know, even the sculpture has a lifespan. So I started to think about the aging process and the inevitability of aging. And, you know, I'm always faced with how much do I lick, how much do I wash. And so I started to think of aging as a kind of creative process. Can we choose how we age ourselves? But also this idea that, you know, if the bust is the way we present ourselves to the world, that bathing and eating are sort of personal activities. And maybe that's a more appropriate way of describing the self. Maybe we're more ourselves with ourselves.
Talking now about trying to locate your practice, I mean, you talk about being interested in feminist art of the 70s, and you have particular ideas about the irony in art of the 80s. But who would you say are the important references for you in recent contemporary art?
Well, I would say I have references from the 70s and the 80s and of my peers. Yes, those early artists, people like, you know, Hannah Wilkie and Carolee Sheeman were big influences on me. What is disturbing to me is how it seems like they've, in a way, been written out of history. And I'm asking myself why, because many artists of my time are looking back to those artists. My education was in the 80s, and I was looking, I mean, at the hot artists at the time were people like Barbara Kruger, Jenny Holzer, Sherry Levine, and those are huge influences on me because that's what I was really thinking about at the time. I think that Sherry Levine made the ultimate statement about appropriation. And then there are the more recent artists, people like Kiki Smith, who have been a great influence on me. But I'm very aware of the fact that I am taking some of the strategies of the artists of the 80s, which used a very different language than I'm using, but inserted their feminism into it. And I think that that's why we couldn't ignore them. Because they used a language which was, you know, the authorities had condoned, but they sort of slipped this feminism in there. What I'm trying to do is take the knowledge that I learned from that and go back to the language that was happening in the 70s and reassert some of those things that I think we need to deal with.
That desire to disrupt and to subvert seems to be something that comes through a lot of your works, perhaps in order to explore something that's much more fundamental, that is to do with imperfection.
I think you're right. But I think that, you know, this idea of perfection is something that I'm working very much against, in the sense that I'm working against these traditional notions of beauty. And I'm hoping that I can sort of push the limits of what the viewer might think of as beautiful.
Thanks. Ginny, now we're in the gallery with your piece here. In fact, sitting on the bed that you sleep in here each night. Is that right? There's an instrument in the gallery to do with the recording of your rapid eye movements. There's a loom here above us, and the bed and the nightgown. Perhaps you could talk about each of these elements.
My first night I slept in the gallery, and I hooked myself up to this machine, which is a polysomnograph, and I hooked up the electrodes to my temples, and I recorded one night of my rapid eye movement. I got the doctors to teach me how to look at those marks and know when I'm in dream state. So what I did is I isolated all those marks, photocopied them onto a graph, and I'm now in the process of weaving all my dreams into a very long blanket. So every night I sleep here, under the blanket, in my nightgown, and when I wake up in the morning, I tear my nightgown into strips, and I weave it into the blanket, and that is actually the line of my dreams. As in the other work, there's a completed cycle where I begin with my body, in the state of dreaming, and that the movement, the physiological response to that state is my rapid eye movement. And so my eyes are moving the pens of this polysomnograph, and then I sort of insert myself into the machine of the loom by spending my entire day weaving those patterns into the blanket. And then at night I receive my dreams again in a transformed state. I'm very interested in creating a space for the viewer in the work, and in all the different kinds of readings that come out of a work. And in this particular piece, when you come in, you are aware of a sort of familiar story, that it seems like a fairy tale or a myth. It's a sort of conglomeration of all these stories of woman weaving. The people who come and experience me as part of the piece are experiencing a certain story. And they will be unique, because the people who come won't experience that. And so the viewer becomes a kind of storyteller. And in all the work, I feel like I'm trying to create this scene that's like coming in on the scene of a crime, that there are all these clues that I've left behind. But the viewer has to make the leap from the loom to the polysomnograph and the scenario of what has happened. And maybe that they would, you know, each viewer might have a different scenario. And what I'm interested in is how fairy tales sort of transform over time, and transform in relationship to the culture and how people are thinking. And the works that have been most interesting to me are Chris Burden shooting himself, Boyce in the gallery with the coyote, or Vito Acconci masturbating under the floor of the gallery. And it suddenly occurred to me that I never saw any of those pieces, but somehow they've become the most vivid images in my mind. And I realized that the way I came to those images is because they've been passed down to me through a kind of oral tradition. You know, maybe I've seen some sort of vague black and white fuzzy photograph, but the reason why they must be so strong is because I created those images. So it's something that I was thinking of exploring through this work, is that, you know, can I create a situation for the viewer to write a story?
The objects all have a narrative, don't they? The loom, which is identified as a process of making that people have to toil over, the piece of hospital equipment which analyzes rapid eye movements and brain transactions, and the bed, which is a very potent symbol. It's where people are born in, where people die in, people conceive in. So even without you here, the absence has a kind of a potency somehow.
Yeah, I'm very anxious to see what happens when I leave, and whether you will experience that absence, and whether in your mind you'll create me.